Great. Thanks so much, Andrea. That's the idea. I'm going to talk about first light. Let me just say, I recently became Californian a few weeks ago. No tan yet.
Any house?
No house yet either. Bring up the sore points now. We made a lot of progress already because we have a logo. One of the ideas there is this new institute that's also a Kavli Institute. It's quite easy. You need $7.5 million, and you get your name on these things.
It's like a new radio station.
That's right. That institute is, from what I understand, about 15 months old right now. I'm the first non-director faculty. Right now we have about 12 postdocs there. I wanted to advertise this. There's going to be a few more positions this year. For some of you in the audience, please apply to those. Okay. What do I want to talk about? Chris did a wonderful job of sort of motivating some of the ideas that drive us in trying to understand really the formation of the very first stars. What I'll be arguing is that sort of the initial stages, all the issues, many of the issues that have to do with primordial protostellar formation are by now actually very well understood. I'm going to explain a little bit how come I think such a preposterous thing.
I understand that one is good data.
There you go. That's why. That's right. What I'll be focusing on, it's protostellar evolution, and sort of building up the whole accretion process that leads to the formation of a fully fledged star. That's what's the really hard part, and Chris already gave you a broad overview of the many processes that make this so complicated. I'm going to iterate a little bit more on the particular point and sort of try to highlight and give you an appreciation for what makes it really difficult. Very often, of course, it is our growing understanding of the difficulties that actually are the progress that we're making. I'm just going to highlight a few things that these presumed massive isolated stars will do to their environment, but leave it to the other speakers in the rest of the week to highlight some more of that, and Mike's going to talk about some work we've been doing together in that area. I think the point that the formation, or that to study the initial collapse and sort of the protostellar phase is an extremely well-specified problem is worthwhile to iterate on here, is the initial conditions are specified within our current models of structure formation. Given lambda CDM, we know what to start with. Not only do we know sort of the initial density and temperature distributions of the gas that the universe should have at these very early times, we also do know, we believe to know all the physics that's relevant to follow the formation of these very first objects. The only thing that's really difficult about this is the immense range of spatial and temporal scales involved. This movie, as we zoomed here through 10 orders of magnitude of length scale as we fly in here. That obviously, sort of what's left then is this protostar that we see accreting very rapidly. It's really the breakthrough in the computational technology, mostly through the use of adaptive mesh refinement of a code that Greg Bryan developed with Mike Norman, that really allowed us to make progress in this field. It's not about that we found out about new physics or new processes that are relevant. It's only that we, for the first time, could really solve it over all the relevant scales. You know the initial conditions, you know the physics, but they are nonlinear, and that's why you do need a computer to really make the kind of progress where you start relying or start to think that you get reliable results and solutions to the complex equations that you write down. The large range of scales is very easy to sort of see. I mean, the simple fact that the Sun is a trillion times smaller than the Milky Way already gives you the idea. If you want to do cosmology and you want to understand star formation, that's what you've got to do. Chris also made that interesting point, of course, that with the timescales, it's the same story. As you go to smaller scale, things, the physics on smaller scales tend to also have much shorter time scales. And so here, just as a simple example, you know, if you have a test particle going around the sun and you compare it to the Hubble time at redshift 30, that's also a factor of trillion in time scales you have to resolve. And in fact, it's only because we can be adaptive in time and space in our numerical approach that we actually are able to do study these type of problems. Okay, so but the simple equation summary that you want to have in mind of what's really done in these things is that on the one hand, we solve for the dark matter dynamics, which all of you have seen many times, and you do that by solving an in-body problem. In our case, on this, on an adaptive hierarchy of grids, you have to include self-gravity of the gas as well as the dark matter. And then for the hydrodynamics, you just solve conservation equations, so simple mass, conservation, momentum, and energy. And then what made things here different in our case compared to the regular star formation community, other than the dark matter, is that we also solve for the fully non-equilibrium kinetic equations that describe the non-equilibrium chemistry in primordial gas. And the very fact here is that it, or of great importance actually to do this in non-equilibrium. In fact, if you would try to write this down in equilibrium, you get you would, for example, find that all primordial gas is in the form of molecular hydrogen, which you know, but then you ask yourself, what's the time scale to acquire that? And it's some 10 to the 400 seconds. So you have to do this in non-equilibrium. And so that one progress we made is that we came up with numerical solvers that are good enough that we can now, on hundreds of millions of grid cells, solve those kinetic equations and evolve them forward in time. That is sort of one thing that allowed them. So some of these things you've seen before, but let me highlight this. What I'm showing are a small fraction of the simulation volume, about 10 co-moving kiloparsecs across, in three different redshifts. In the lower row here for the dark matter, and in the upper bit for the gas. What the typical story that arises is that you make very small halos first. You make small dark matter halos. In our case, we have a dark matter resolution in this particular calculation of one solar mass per particle. So these are sort of 50 to 100 particles clumping in these small things. And you see there is no corresponding counterparts in the gas. So all the structure initially is driven completely by the dark matter. And then the smallest objects, their potential wells are too shallow to drive in any of the gas. So that's just the finite pressure of the gas, simple chain smoothing, that does not allow these very smallest objects, which are really, in some sense, the first structures in the universe, to the more dark matter dominated halos, to contain any gas and do anything more interesting. It's only once they start merging into larger and larger objects that you see sort of regions of about 10 to the 4 solar masses also being able to drag in some of the gas. But even there, you actually just visually, you see that these are fairly boring objects. These are round adiabatic gas balls where, you know, dark matter gravity is balanced by the pressure of the gas. And so they don't do much. And all, you know, just from the structure alone, you see the pressure plays a very important role. They're spherical. So even as you smash them into each other, well, of course, you have some turbulence created, you know, by this motion. It's damped very rapidly because you're so pressure dominated. Only as you build up to yet larger objects between the size of 10 to the 5 to 10 to the 6 solar masses, do you see some sort of deformation here. You see how some of the filaments stick in, and now we get into a regime where we are above the Jeans mass. So now gravity, at least on sort of the outer scales, dominates by far the pressure of the gas. Okay, now there's a long story that sort of happens in between this picture and the one that I'm showing down here. This is now just about 40 AU across. What happened is that this 10 to the 6 solar mass object from molecular hydrogen, it started radiating some of its internal energy. Pressure was lost, and the gas started to contract. Now, as the collapse occurs, and let me perhaps just put a few spins in here that relate to what we talked about fragmentation earlier today, is as the gas cloud makes enough molecular hydrogen, you start to cool. The gas contracts. As it gets to critical density of about 10 to the 4, 10 to the 5 particles per cubic centimeter, the cooling becomes independent of the density. So that all the cooling that you get is just always the same per molecule that you have. So now your cooling time is independent of density, but of course your dynamical time gets shorter and shorter as you collapse to higher densities. So as a consequence, one simple necessary condition from fragmentation is not fulfilled anymore, which is that you need to cool faster than the dynamical time. Right? And this is just shut off once you made all the H2 and you're contracting. What happens is you're contracting quasi-hydrostatically. And actually, if you pay attention to the movie before, what you saw in these isodensity contours, they got rounder and rounder on intermediate scales. And that's just pressure was balancing gravity. But at the same time as this this core of about 100 solar masses that's undergoing contraction goes down, you're still radiating some of its energy, right? But it, the whole time it's trying to get into hydrostatic equilibrium. Now that damps many of the density fluctuations that you would have from the more turbulent, or trying to be created from the more turbulent surroundings of it. And as a consequence, you end up not being able to break up this lump into small fragments. That's one of the reasons, at least on intermediate scales, that gives you a single 100 solar mass core that's undergoing rapid contraction. It's cooling at about 100,000 year time scale to 10,000 year time scale.
So what do you think of the thermal dissipation? That's
actually the beauty of it. We can do all of this analytically now. And so the, you know the minimum temperature you can cool to is just the lowest lying rotational level of H2. So that gets you to about 200 Kelvin. The critical density where the molecular cooling behavior changes is about 10 to the 4 to 10 to the 5 particles per cubic centimeter. If you now evaluate a Bonnet-Ebert mass, which is the same as a Jeans mass but for an isothermal profile, density profile, you get exactly the 100 solar masses that are picked out right there. So the way you want to imagine is you have a cooling flow, all the cold stuff assembles in the center of the dark matter potential well. And as you build up too much of that mass, you get a new critical mass scale for collapse, just given by molecular properties alone. And then as you pile up enough of that material, this one starts collapsing further. Actually, even on that scale, you're far from any angular momentum barrier because it's more like a cooling flow. Whatever gas gets there is piled on. So if you imagine, if you try to put in more turbulence, what would happen is that you have to wait a little longer. And in fact, we've shown that in our calculations with Naoki Yoshida, that the minimum mass scale in which one of these stars forms depends on how rapidly the mass of the halo is increasing. So the higher the accretion rate of objects, of dark matter objects, the more turbulent heating you get, and the longer it takes for molecular cloud to form that will then lead to a core like this. And what's interesting then is that there's a new instability as this 100 solar mass object's contracting. And that one comes about from the three-body formation of molecular hydrogen. Initially, we had about 10 to the minus 3 in molecular fraction. As we get to densities high enough, the three-body processes play a role. We get to at about 10 to the 9 particles per cubic centimeter, you end up having collisions between three neutral hydrogen atoms, making one molecular hydrogen, getting out one neutral hydrogen atom. You, of course, a three-body process is a very fast process because as soon as it becomes important, you go to slightly higher density, it goes with 1 over density squared in the time scale. Now, this is a very rapid transition, and Francesco Palla and Joe Silk in the early 80s have argued that this will break up the cloud into smaller mass stars, perhaps between 0.1 and 1 solar masses. And this instability absolutely works, and it works in the calculations that we've done. And in fact, it makes this 1 solar mass core that's fully molecular, but that's accreting from the outside. But what we find is that it doesn't break it up into small lumps. It just makes one core in the center. And there's now numerous reasons. For one, we didn't have enough density fluctuations to let it fragment. The other one is that in any fragmentation scenario, what's going to happen is that you initially cool isobarically, right? So as we now go from 10 minus 3 our molecular fraction to fully molecular, our cooling time all of a sudden drops by a factor of 1,000, right? So very much more rapid cooling. However, the gas cannot cool to much lower temperatures. It's always still bounded by the lowest temperature it can cool to because it's molecular hydrogen. There are no lower rotational levels available. So now what's happened is, okay, you get unstable, sort of chemothermally unstable regions, but they don't manage to collapse or contract fast enough to run away from being mixed back in into the surrounding medium. And as a consequence, again, it's only the very central regions that where you see that instability growing. And it's one solar mass star or protostar starts running away quicker than its envelope. The beauty, of course, is that we just went through the exercise doing analytically what the 100 solar masses came from. Well, now there's a new instability at about 10,000 times higher density, more or less the same temperature. So, you know, from your genes mass scaling, you know, well, it has to be 100 times lower mass, and it's one solar mass. And so, again, you understand analytically where that part comes from. And so, you know, up to this point, I do think that there's, we understand the process extremely well. Trouble, of course, is now we became fully molecular, and that core becomes optically thick to its own cooling radiation. Let me perhaps also make another quick point that's sometimes unclear if you're unfamiliar with adaptive mesh refinement. Very often people think we only find one object because that's what we focus on, that our numerical technique for some reason wouldn't be able to follow, you know, hundreds of objects if they were to form. And one easy way to see that that's not the case is just looking at the grid structure of one particular object. And what this shows are sort of the grid boxes over which we solve all the partial differential equations that I summarized earlier. This is sort of the top grid box. We identify, you know, across-lying grids with each other, so we assume periodic boundary conditions on the very large scale. Then in our initial conditions, we focus on a region that we know will form an object of sort of the size, or the one I was discussing, and provide very high resolution initial conditions in this particular region. And then as a simulation progresses, it adds the grids to track the accuracy of the solution. So most of the refinement that we use just focuses on following the mass. But there's one other criterion where we ensure that we always resolve the gene's length by at least 64 cells. So that means a region that's already thinking about collapse already has over 100,000 cells in it before it starts contracting. And so that's level 5. You see it made in this particular case 2,000 grid patches. All the level 6 grids are embedded in these ones, so it's always staggered, of course. At level 8, you see you still have over 100 different patches. At level 9, you still have all of these, but there's only one of them that actually contains levels of, or only grids of a higher level. It's only contained in one. However, if you would have made many more objects, it would have just kept zooming in, just exactly like it did here, tracking the interesting parts of the flow. As you go then way down, you often already see sort of elongated structures just from the grid boxes alone. You see if things spun up and you get a disc-like structure there. Another point here is that turbulence does play a significant role, and this is a very busy plot. The different colors relate to different output times in the particular calculation. this wide top lines correspond to the final output that we still study. It's here where the core becomes optically thick to its own cooling radiation, and that's why we don't trust to run the calculation further. Just the simple solid line is just the potential energy at this time. And the other ones added up here is just the combination of the thermal plus the turbulent energy in the gas. And so all I had done is I took the most central dense point, I went out in spherical averages, defined shells that contain this much mass interior to it, and asked on this shell, what's per particle, my potential energy, and my thermal and my turbulent energy. One thing that you notice is that over the scale of 100 solar masses down to one solar mass, I'm actually in virial equilibrium. And that's the potential thermal and turbulent energies track each other. And that's exactly the effect that you're not in a free fall collapse. Right? And that is what allows you to damp all these density perturbations that you would have liked in this cloud. You see, let's see. And on the top, I compare the turbulent velocity, just the 3D RMS velocity of the gas, with the local sound speed. And you see, in the whole region, you're actually sonic. So it's just in regions where you make the initial clump, you get RMS velocities faster than the sound speed, as well as then in the region of the one solar mass protostar. Okay. And so that's one of the things that we can address here, which perhaps is somewhat more difficult in analytical investigations currently. But as also Chris explained earlier, all the arguments that we've put forward about the potential masses of the first stars really just have to do, to a large extent, with just looking at this simple diagram where we plot the accretion time as a function of enclosed gas mass. So all you do is you look at the radial profile around the densest object and ask, well, how long is it going to take it at the current radial velocity that it's going to make it to the center? Or you can do this, weight it correctly with the density, but you see it doesn't make a difference, those two curves. So you just ask, okay, given this initial data, how long will it take to make that star? And then you compare it to the Kelvin-Helmholtz time, which you can compute once you have models for zero metal stars at their zero age main sequence. And just compare, will a star of a few solar masses be able to act back onto the accretion flow to just hold this enormous amount of material that's coming down at about 10 to the minus 2 solar masses a year? And so it's all based on these arguments. So one interesting point is where it crosses over at about 120 solar masses, is where the accretion time is equal to the Kelvin-Helmholtz time. Perhaps that's one argument to cut it off. Well, if it takes much longer than a million years for the accretion, well, that's longer than the lifetime of the stars. And you'd argue, well, that's probably a good upper limit. And so the lower limits come from that. So there's no much sophistication in the way we initially proposed sort of the range between 30 and 300 solar masses for a plausible range of within which the first stars could be. And of course, Chris McKee and Jonathan Tan outlined a number of some of the other mechanisms that, that are relevant there. So the progress has been then that we were able to do this numerically, but also that we now understand many of the scales that come in analytically. So all the mass scales that's involved, all the time scales that are involved, we can do now purely analytically, and that's gratifying in some sense. Okay, and I think I said most of these things already. The only one I haven't focused on is that the feedbacks that you get as this first star forms clearly will inhibit the formation of any other star in the same halo, in the same object that we considered. And that's very easy to understand. There's only 10 to the 57 hydrogen molecules in this entire halo around it. And one star will produce that in a year. And so it will very quickly just dissociate all the molecules around it, and you have a very hard time of let another fragment cool and make a star in a sufficiently fast time scale. Trouble is, of course, that also the cooling time scale in the cold regions in this halo is already of the order of a million years. So that's very close to the lifetime of just one of such star forming. So that's where this conclusion that you think we make massive stars that are isolated is all based on. And, well, it's still progress, even though we can't give you an exact mass. Before we did these simulations, if you go in the literature, you find practically everything from Jupiter-sized objects to supermassive black holes, and all starting with exactly the same initial conditions. In that sense, that we still learn something, even though we, of course, want to know a lot more. So what's stopping us is processes like understanding the luminosity evolution of the protostar now do the rate of transfer of the molecular hydrogen cooling lines. Think of that formidable task. You have hundreds of molecular lines now that you want to track as this forms over a very wide range, again, of length and time scale. Then there is actually a new instability, I think, that hadn't been discussed before in the literature that we just did recently, which has to do with collisional-induced emission. That's just as the protostar gets even denser, it now starts cooling in the continuum. And in the continuum, at least for about a factor of 10 or so in density, will be optically thin. So first H2 lines get optically thick, and now you have a new emission mechanism, and that one's, you know, can't see through the molecular lines. And now you think there could be a new mass scale that comes out. And in fact, it does. It's 5 times 10 to the minus 3 solar masses, and it is exactly what makes the protostellar core that's even within the one solar mass protostar that we've seen there, which then will accrete very rapidly. And let's see. And then, of course, you have to do the transfer of the UV continuum, as Chris highlighted there. And eventually, of course, the explicit hydrodynamics that we're doing will not be adequate anymore. You're trying to follow over a very long time scale the buildup of that star, whereas the sound waves want to travel on sort of minute time scales. So these are things that we have to overcome. That I think I just said that in words with a collisional-induced emission. But a couple of these things I think we've solved already now. And the one is, I want to perhaps highlight here, is work I did with Emanuele Ripamonti, who's now at Groningen, was a postdoc with me at Penn State, is where we look at just the transfer of the molecular lines alone. It's very interesting. You can write down analytically an escape probability formalism, since we now, once you know analytically what the object is that forms, sort of the mass scale that becomes critical, you know the optical depths through that object. And now, so you work out some escape probability formalism and then just say, okay, I'll get an effective cooling rate per baryon in this cloud. And the nice thing is, Emanuele had developed a code where you can do 1D Lagrangian hydrodynamics with all the radiative transfer of all the molecular lines. And what we did is, we ran his code one time with my simple little analytic formula that's about this long, and sort of, and compared it to the results he gets when he does the full transfer of thousands of lines and tens of thousands of frequency bins. And the results are shown here, but they're overlaid. You can't tell the difference. What's remarkable is that even in the velocity field, you know, the code runs 100 times faster. I mean, the one time you really do full transfer, and the other time you just fudge a cooling function, and you get exactly the same results, not only in the log-log plots, but actually also in the velocities. And so that I'm very optimistic with now, that this will allow us to actually study and sort of the next phase of the formation of the protostar and the initial phases of accretion in full 3D, and some of the questions of will I form a disk, you know, an early disk, what are sort of this early evolution up to densities perhaps of sort of 10 to the 18, 10 to the 19 particles per cubic centimeter will be realistic. That's great. So, okay, we have some fudge to get around doing the full transfer of molecular lines. But, of course, what we would like to do is just do all the physics correctly in 1D. And here we use implicit radiation hydrodynamics, and we're making some progress. But one of the biggest things we're learning is how hard the problem is, even in just 1D. And what you notice is, even when you're just up to one solar mass as a star forms, you get very high accretion shocks. And the transfer, rate of transfer of that will be challenging. And I had a couple of things just to mention about that. I guess we're going to hear from this from Nick Netting, some work we did on how you can do an approximate scheme for radiative transfer in 3D that I think is good enough that we could apply it to some of the problems we have in the first star case. And this will be good in particular for not particularly isotropic radiation fields. But if you get to the question of H2 regions, you want to go to more a scheme that's an exact radiative transfer scheme that allows for highly anisotropic radiation sources, that it gives you, allows you to track shadows as you make the H2 regions. And so I have to, unfortunately, sort of, let me just say this in words, what happens once the star actually switches on? We talked about the H2 region that limits the accretion onto the protostar. But no matter what happens, once you have the massive star, it will create an H2 region in the halo that it's in. In the one of the simple effects we found here with Dan Whale and Mike Norman was that just that simple H2 region alone will drive out all the gas in the halo, you know, in which that star formed. So as you now, as the star explodes and tries to deliver its metals out, it actually has to run through a shell of ionized material that's already running out at about 30 kilometers a second. So all the metal mixing that we're interested in will most likely happen at a scale of about 100 parsec, and it's material that is still running out. So there's going to be a lot of interesting effects there. And so my collaborators moved to Greg Ryan just went to Columbia, Emanuele is in Groningen now, and Mike and Brian are here today. So in conclusions, you know, the one thing you always want to take home is that these are, we do think we make massive stars, they form in isolation, will not have planets. I really didn't talk much about that, but the predicting the exact initial mass value of these stars instead of a function will take quite a bit more work on the numerical side to do this. But what's perhaps relevant to this workshop as well is that if this H2 regions drive out all the gas of the halos, what that tells you is that the UV escape fraction, meaning how many of the UV photons that the first star has made will actually make it into the intergalactic medium, is close to unity. Only a few percent of their photons might be used up to ionize their host halos. And so let me just stop here. Thanks.
I got the mic. So how many first stars do you think there are, were in the universe, and could you make one today?
So this is a question of biasing here. It's if we potentially, in the region that eventually makes the Milky Way, I think you have room to make about 10 of the 5 of these first stars. And it's all the feedback mechanisms that we'll actually be discussing all this week that have something to say about this. One effect that Marie Mahacek, Greg Ryan, and I discussed was we did these full-blown 3D MR simulations with a soft UV background field. And what we found is that all the conditions are more or less just the same. The only thing that differed was you had to wait for some of the halos to attain a larger mass before you made enough cool material that it will run away. And so it's this exact evolution now of what is that minimum mass of all these halos that will make one star is one important ingredient to work that out. But I imagine it's going to be somewhere between 10 to the 4 and 10 to the 5 of these stars in the region of the Milky Way, which then will mean due to
so that that's about 10 to the minus 6 of the total baryons, is that right?
Yes, that could go in there.
And could you make one in the low density region today?
And there, it's sort of with due to natural biasing, all early objects I imagine will be enriched by this. It's very often sort of people overlook this very simple fact, right? That of course the power spectrum is very flat on small scales, and you have a lot of structure formation going on at the same time. So in this region, you might have a 10 to the 9 solar mass object assembling as a 10 to the 6 forms here. But in the region that makes the 10 to the 9, you always had a 10 to the 6 solar mass object forming quite a bit earlier, because all the modes add up linearly. And so all these objects, at least for the sort of highest sigma peaks, you imagine always have been enriched with that, pre-enriched with first stars. So, you know, you have to get a bit more clever, I think, to design a scheme to make it in the low density region today.
Well, sorry, the question was a different one. Could you hope to observe an object like this in a void at redshift 0.1?
Yeah. Well, exactly. So I believe no. I would have to give you the whole scenario that, but I'm not sure.
All right, it's up to you. You choose the
we went on this quite a bit already.
Okay, yeah, just going back to the radiative transfer and why it didn't matter. Could you comment on that?
So,
you did the full radiative transfer in 1D, yeah, and you found that you got the analytic answer?
The nice thing is that it's only one molecule, and the way that sort of the transition probabilities in H2 work is that already those are analytic. So it's the time scales of the decays from the rotational levels have a simple parallel scaling. And as you fold that in into the parallel scalings that give you the unstable mass scale, you at the end still get a simple power law, which then just works a lot more better than we would have expected.
Okay. You have a finite simulation box, and obviously there could be objects far away that were higher sigma peaks that would affect the box, even though simply because they send out photons and the UV background can suppress molecular hydrogen formation. So have you done the exercise within your box to make sure that then the behavior of that box is not affected by more distant sources?
Well, I mean, that was the whole goal of that study that I alluded to earlier with that we did with Marie Mahacek, where we actually just said, okay, even given for a small simulation volume, let's study it on the influence of a soft UV background and explore whether we find differences. The only difference that we found is that the minimum halo mass had to scale up. Sort of the key of the simulations is not, I mean, of course, you know, the first star in the observable universe with a standard power spectrum without a rolling index would be observable at redshift 70, right? If you're really interested in the very, very first star, you want to sort of focus on that particular one alone. I think the way you want to look at this is that the, you're doing okay as long as the mass accretion rate history that you get for this particular object is a realistic one. I think that's what you focus on. You're not trying to do the whole observable universe and just pick out one particular object. It's more about learning the physical aspects of it of the collapse rather than representation of the.
Two questions. One is related to what Simon was asking, can the first star form today? And you discussed the metals, but surely even if there was a metal-free region today forming stars, a big difference would be that it would be ionized and 10,000 degree Kelvin. So maybe you want to say what the implication would be of that. Second question is, how many first stars did you simulate? How many different ones?
So the second one first, it's sort of, we did, I guess if we add it all up, probably 800 different ones or so down to the level of the molecular cloud. Well, it's actually more.
A lot.
Sort of,
anyway.
Of that, yeah, quite a lot. We did quite a bit fewer all the way down to this smaller scale. And that's as just the computational expenses is quite dramatic once you go to these scales. But of course, there will be a lot more as we now have more and more physics that makes sense to go to even higher densities. For the other one aspect, I think you can imagine of cooking up scenarios where you keep material ionized or ionize it very early on and then try to keep it ionized and far enough away from metals that you get this void in which you still have pristine primordial gas today. And then you'd imagine having a dwarf galaxy as the UV photon background drops, that you now get neutral regions inside this dark matter potential well, and now you have primordial material trying to make a primordial star. And sort of theoretically, I think that works quite well. It's just based, if you look at local group dwarf spheroidals, if they any hint of sort of what the smallest galaxies can make, it really looks like far from that you ever have a chance of doing something like that. So here it's the data that actually makes a difference why I think we know that it's going to be difficult to do that.
Tom, we heard about the importance of angular momentum this morning from your ensemble of 800 or so regions. What can you say about the angular momentum distribution, and how confident are you that you're doing the transport of angular momentum correctly?
Yeah, so the intriguing thing is that even for the highest resolution ones we've done, is we only see a little bit of angular momentum transport. There's only a slight hint of it at the very latest parts, where you have a few solar masses going further down. All the evolution that allows material to pile up at the very center is you would only call angular momentum segregation, is that you have a fully turbulent cloud in which there's always low angular momentum material. And it's the one with the lowest angular momentum that piles up in the very center. And so it's only in contradiction if you think of a, you know, sort of solid body rotating cloud. But if you think of a turbulent cloud, you actually can segregate a lot of mass through. And that's actually, so, you know, even over this crazy dynamic range, most of the effect we see. And I think that's going to be also, again, the exciting thing is we now can go about another factor of 100 or so in collapse further, that will actually see how important the actual turbulent transport of angular momentum is, not just the segregation. So in that sense, it turns out incredibly robust. I mean, we varied, you know, refinement from using 4 cells per chain length to 64. We did 2 different types of hydro schemes, and we got the same angular momentum profiles.
I'll say it again. Just a follow-up to your comment about the angular momentum transport. One of the worries with adaptive mesh refinement is with regard to angular momentum transport, because the angular momentum may be affected by the tidal torquing from larger distribution of matter, and as you refine the mass distribution, you may effectively decouple the scale you're refining from the tidal torquing that might affect it.
Sure, there's a lot of worries. I mean, the interesting thing, however, what you want to keep in mind is that our initial conditions already have one cell only contains 0.1 solar masses in gas. So we're actually never, you know, splitting it up into large chunks. And so we definitely could construct simulations where you can make a breakdown. What I'm saying is, if you have such high resolution in the initial conditions, and you vary your refinement criteria dramatically, where, you know, it's a difference between a code running in a day to a month in 64 processor machine, it actually didn't make a difference anymore. So, but I certainly agree, if you started out with too little resolution, you're not going to get the right answer.
Okay. Thanks. Thank you very much.